Good evening, everybody. So tonight, this is the second last Smichas Chavashir of this Zman. Next week, Bez Hashem will be our last one. And then we start studying for the Bechina, I guess. But we'll start with a Dvar Torah related to the Parsha, not really related to anything else, just related to the Parsha and I guess Chodesh Elul, because Rav Liadad didn't give us one, so we'll say something of our own. You know, when you look in Tanakh, there are certain people and there are certain groups of people that are considered to be villains in Tanakh, that are the people that, we want to stay away from. Sometimes there's a connection between the individuals and the nations, meaning our problem with Edom, for example, and with Amalek started with a guy, and his name was Esav, and that's where Edom came from, that's where Amalek came from. The vilification of Ammon and Moab, though, is a little bit of a more curious kind of thing. They're both descendants of Lot, and they were conceived in incest, but that doesn't seem to be the problem, meaning the problem does not seem to be how they were conceived in incest, meaning the Malchus Beis David was also conceived in incest. The problem and the reason for the banishment Mikal Hashem for Ammon and Moab is because Al Dvar Asher Elokeinu Maschem B'Lechem U'Mayim B'Derech B'Seischem Mitzrayim, is because they didn't provide us with bread and water. And it seems a little bit strange. Why is that such a terribly important thing that they didn't provide us with bread and water? And, you know, especially when you consider the fact that our needs in the Midbar were somewhat minimal. We did not need bread and we did not need water from the likes of Ammon and Moab. We had much more delicious and nutritious food in the form of the man, which is a very rare combination of deliciousness and nutritiousness. Usually those two things don't always go hand in hand, but we had that in the man, and we had much cleaner and sweeter water from the Be'er than anything that they could offer us. So why are we so interested in their bread and water anyway, that we get so upset that they didn't offer us bread and water? And once we're on the topic of food, there's something unusual about the halachos of Birchas Hananin. In order to be obligated to recite a bracha achrona on a food or a beverage, one has to have a shir, a kazayis, a revius. But in order to be obligated to recite a bracha rishona on a food or a beverage, a kol shehu, even the tiniest amount, and a person has to recite a bracha. Why that discrepancy? And if there was going to be a discrepancy, I would have thought of it in the other direction. I would have said that for a bracha achrona, which can sometimes be a chiv midar raisa, we should be more machmir. That since sometimes it could be a chiv midar raisa, so even on way less than the chiv midar raisa, even on the teeniest, tiniest amount, the rabbanon should be misaki in a bracha. But bracha rishona, which the whole institution is only mitrabbanon, so why are they going to be so machmir that even the tiniest amount is going to require bracha rishona? So there's the yesod that perhaps helps answer all of these questions. You know, here in shul, one of the things I've been doing for many years is that when there are little children that come up to me after davening, I give them one of these. I give them, I can't always keep in my shender, a pack of these disgusting-looking rainbow-colored Twizzlers. So every child walks away with sticky hands, with a Twizzler that matches whatever their favorite food coloring is, and I make sure they get their daily recommended value of cornstarch and glycerin and blue 1 and red 40. So they have 800% of the daily recommended value of red 40 by the time they walk. So once I gave a child one of these Twizzlers, and his father told me later on that his son said to him, you know, the rabbi gave me this sticky, yucky candy, and I wanted to throw it out because it was so yucky, but the rabbi was walking behind me out of shul, so I couldn't throw it out, so I had to eat it. Let me ask you a very simple question. When I see that child again, should I not give him a Twizzler? And now that I know what he feels about my gift to him, and the answer, of course, I should give him one, because it's not because I feel that he needs to get his daily recommended value of red number 40 or the nutrition that this Twizzler provides. It's because the purpose of them is to know that the rabbi is their friend and he wants to give them a treat and he wants to to make them smile, and that's always what you're trying to accomplish. So most of us are probably familiar with the concept of love languages, right? The concept of the five love languages, which is, you know, these days, for those of us who teach chasanim and kalas, it's like standard reading material to learn the different love languages. One of the most misunderstood of the love languages is gift giving. For those who speak the love language of gifts, the act of giving and receiving is symbolic of the relationship itself. It's supposed to be a tangible expression of a sense of connection, of a sense of love between two people. It's a way to express emotion when emotion is difficult to put into words. It's a way to commemorate a special occasion, a milestone, that, you know, you have something, you have an object that you look at, and it brings back the memory of that time, right? When many of us probably I have in my office certain gifts that I've received from people. There's a picture, a painting on the wall of Rav Huttner and Rav Moshe Feinstein that was given to me by a Talmud after he went through a particularly difficult time. So, you know, I remember I have a baseball on my shelf signed by Andy Pettit, and it was a gift from a Talmud who at the time, as an 11th grader, was thinking, what's the best gift in the entire world that I could possibly give to anybody? And at that stage of his life, the greatest thing he could possibly think of was a baseball signed. But and now he's a Rebbe in his own, but you know, but that was so, it's so meaningful to me because of the, now, do I need a baseball signed by Andy Pettit? Do I need, what practical benefit am I going to get from it? But I once told a Maisa about an offensive lineman before the Super Bowl. That was a whole fancy Musar Shmuz I built around the Maisa, and the Talmud found the football card of that offensive lineman, and he got me an autographed copy of that football card, which they're not making more of because I believe the guy committed suicide. So I now have it, meaning not because I need it, but the thoughtfulness of it. That's what the concept of giving gift is. It's not to provide some practical benefit. It's not to provide some practical need for the person. The thoughtfulness, the intentionality behind the gift that makes a person feel loved, it makes a person feel appreciated. And it's not about materialism. It's not about consumerism. It's not about any of that stuff. It's about the emotional significance and the thoughtfulness behind the act of giving and the act of receiving. So when one provides a service, it might be appreciated. But when you demonstrate a relationship, that's much more than providing a service. That runs much, much deeper. The Mishnah and Sota and Daf Tes tells us, Miriam himtina l'Moshe shah achas, shenemar v'tesatava chosome rechok, that Miriam waited for Moshe Rabbeinu for shah achas, when he was placed in the water, l'fichach nis'akfu la Yisrael zayin yamin b'midbar. And therefore, the entire Jewish nation had to wait for her for 7 days in the midbar when she was afflicted with tzaras, shenemar v'am l'nasa'at ha'asif Miriam. So as a reward for waiting for Moshe, for Shah Achas, the entirety of Klal Yisrael waited for her for a full week. So the Gemara there on Daf Yud Aleph asks, Mi dami? Hasam chadashayta hacha shaviyomi. Where's the Mita Kedeket Mita? She waited for 1 minute, and they have to wait for a whole week? How is that? How does it make sense? So the explanation seems to be that Miriam wasn't forced to wait. She did it out of a feeling of genuine concern for her brother. Klal Yisrael had to wait. It wasn't their choice. So in order to match a moment of real interest, a moment of real love, a moment of real compassion, the response, if it's going to be obligatory, has to be an exponentially greater amount than the initial act, because it's obligatory. It's not something that's a genuine sense of love. Rav Druk points out that commonly, when one person greets another person, they say shalom, and commonly the response is shalom shalom, right? A double shalom. Well, why is that? And he says, because when you take notice of somebody else and you say shalom because you've taken notice of them, you're showing that you've noticed somebody. You're taking the initiative to acknowledge the existence of another person. When they respond, it's an obligatory response. So it better be in a much greater quantity. It better be much bigger. So based on this, Rashi writes in Brachas Taf Lamed Hei that when explaining the concept of Bracha Rishona, Rashi writes, El svarahu, the kimit nena tzarech lo, the smisha baram, that the bracha rishon is a svara, that you got hana'a, or you're getting hana'a, so you have to give thanks for the hana'a that you're about to get. So the idea of the bracha rishona, however, if you look carefully at Rashi, he doesn't just say you're getting hana'a and therefore you need to say a bracha. Lahodos lemisha baram. You have to show gratitude to the one who created the food. Meaning, it's not about the food. It's about the one who's providing the food. It's about God. It's about the fact that God thought of us and gave us something. Bracha achrona is about the food. It's about what we consumed. It's v'achalta, v'savata, and therefore, uvirachta. So when something is about what you actually consumed, it's the materialism, it's the consumerism, it's the stuff, it's the thing, well then, the chiyuv is not going to be as great. The chiyuv is only going to be if you had a much larger quantity. But when it's about the relationship, it doesn't matter how big it is. When it's about the relationship, even if it's tiny, even if it's the smallest piece, it's going to demand a bracha. The Medrash explains our relationship with Ammon and Moav. The Medrash Rabbah in Parshas Bahar writes, "Mi hein shalo asu chesed, imi shalo hayitzrichim chesed." Who are the example of people who did chesed with people who did not need chesed? Ammoni and Moavi, or who didn't do chesed, rather, with people who didn't need chesed, and they suffered because they didn't do chesed with people who never needed it in the first place. That's Ammon and Moav. D'chsev al dvar asher lo kidmas chem b'lechem u'b'mayim. V'chitzrichen hayu lam li'Yisrael? Did we need lechem ayim? Lo kol asher b'am shan shor yisrael b'midbar haya aman yorid lehen v'be'er olav v'aslav matzui lehem. We had man, we had the be'er, we had the slav, and then he covered makifel sasam, we had the protection and then he covered. We didn't need ways. We had the Amuran in front. We had everything we needed. Elo derech eretz. Now the problem with Ammon and Moav was a failure in derech eretz. Habamin aderech makdim lam Michael mishta. Ma parlan kodesh baruch hu. And what did Hashem punish them with? Mitoch kach loyava Ammoni Moavi. So therefore loyava Ammoni Moavi b'kal Hashem. All the more so you'd be punished if the people actually needed it and you didn't do anything. But essentially what the Medrash is doing is it's acknowledging we didn't need the bread, we didn't need the water. But Derech Eretz dictates when people are traveling and they stop in your home, you offer them a cold drink, you offer them a bite to eat, you show them where the restroom is, you show that their existence registers with you. The gift of bread and water is not so much about filling practical needs. It's about generating an emotional bond. It's about showing that I care about you, that I recognize you, that I see you. So the rejection of Ammon and Moav from Kal Hashem is not on account of their doing something terrible. It's on account of the very foundational need of a Jew, which is to care about other people, to look at other people. A person who's going to be defined by a midah of selfishness cannot belong to an Am that's built on concern for other people. That's the nature. We're rachmanim. That's the nature of Klal Yisrael. And therefore, they can't come l'kal Hashem. You know, it's fascinating to me just to connect this to the time of year that we're in, that the Rambam doesn't discuss Elul as a meaningful time, as far as I know. The Rambam talks a lot about the Aser Simei Tshuva, talks a lot about Rosh Hashanah, a lot about Yom Kippur, some very famous passages about all three of those things, about the Rosh Hashanah, Aser Simei Tshuva, Yom Kippur. They say that the Rambam put 10 parakim of Hilchos Tshuva to be learned as a curriculum, one parak each on each of the days of Aser Simei Tshuva. Why didn't he have 40 parakim or something so that you can go through Elul also and learn everything there is, you know, throughout Chodesh Elul? Nothing about Chodesh Elul. And the reason seems to be that there really aren't any halachas relating to Elul. There's nothing in halacha. You know, there are minhagim, we say l'david, that's a later minhag and perhaps of dubious origin, but we do it anyway. The Svardim say slichos al chodesh Elul, but the concept of Elul is the opportunity to show the Ribbono Shel Olam that we're willing to do a little bit more, that we're willing to pay a little more attention, to be a little more attentive without any obligation. Meaning that's good for the point. There are no mitzvos, there are no special halachos, and yet we're still going to do something. And that's what it's all about. You know, of all of the acronyms for the month of Elul, and it's a very easy acronym to make, because, Lamed is a prefix and Vav is a connector, so Ani, Liv, you could put it in almost anything. But the most popular one is one of the Mishnah Berurah quotes, I think from the Abhidharma and others, that Ani Li Dodi, V'Dodi Li. that's what Elul is. It's about I am to my beloved and my beloved is to me. It's our love language with the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's Elul in a nutshell. That's Avodas Hashem in a nutshell. That there's nothing that we can give to Hashem. Any gift we're going to give is something he doesn't need. It's the lechem that he doesn't need. It's the mayim that he doesn't need. It's something that, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu needs for nothing. But he would love to see that he is our beloved and that we think of him all the time and that we demonstrate that love with the gift or the gesture of extra diligence in serving the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that's the avoda during Elul. I always recommend, I may have mentioned it last week, I keep on mentioning it because it seems to strike a chord with people who take it seriously, that my recommendation during Chodesh Elul is to take upon ourselves two small kabbalos for the duration of Chodesh Elul through Yom Kippur, two small things. And then in the Ni'ilah of Yom Kippur, decide which one we're going to make a permanent fixture in our lives. Once we've taken it for a test run, and we can see which one's easy, which one's hard, which one is more meaningful to us, we could decide which one is going to be reserved for Elul as something that showed our intensity for these 40 days, and which one is going to be a permanent fixture in our lives. Because we should always change. We should always be able to say that I've grown, that I've become different because of this Elul, but we should also have that experience of knowing that we had that time in our lives, that time of the year, rather, that's more intense than other times. Okay.